Welcome to the KSTE Farm Hour. Here's KSTE's Farmer Fred, Fred Hoffman.
The State Water Project has released its first water allocation numbers for 2021, and it's a kind of a small number. Which county is the number one county in the country for ag production? Here's a clue. It's right here in California. There's a record California pistachio crop this year. We have the numbers. And it's a great season for Christmas tree and poinsettia sales. We talk with two Northern California businesses who are deeply involved with these important seasonal commodities. All that and more on this week's KSTE Farm Hour. Let's get started. It's no surprise California is off to a dry start for the water year, and the California Department of Water Resources has announced an initial state water project allocation of just 10% of requested supplies for the 2021 water year. Initial allocations are based on conservative assumptions regarding hydrology and other factors such as reservoir storage. Allocations are reviewed monthly, and they may change based on snowpack and runoff information. They are typically finalized by May. The Department of Water Resources' eight precipitation stations in Northern California recorded a record low 0% of average rainfall in October and just 53% in November. Most of the state's major reservoirs are lower than historical average to date compared to a year ago. For example, Lake Shasta, that's the federal government's Central Valley Project largest reservoir, is at 75%, and that compares to 119% in 2019. Lake Oroville, the State Water Project's largest reservoir, holds 61%. Compare that to last year, 90%. And San Luis Reservoir, which is a joint use facility for both the Central Valley Project and the State Water Project, now holds 76%, and that compares to 72% of its historical average to date in 2019. That 10% initial allocation amounts to about 422,000 acre-feet of water distributed among the 29 long-term State Water Project contractors who serve more than 27 million Californians, as well as 750,000 acres of farmland. By the way, last year's initial allocation also was 10%. The final allocation in May last year, 20%. Nearly all areas served by the State Water Project have sources of water other than the SWP allocation. They're streams, groundwater, and local reservoirs. And the Department of Water Resources will hopefully put on their snowshoes and conduct the season's first snow survey at Phillips Station in the Sierra Nevada on December 30th. On average, the snowpack supplies about 30% of California's water needs as it melts in the spring and in the early summer.
The National Weather Service's latest seasonal outlook for the December, January, and February period takes into account the existence of La Nina.
That is a phenomenon that tends to lead to very predictable weather across the United States. You may still not get the day-to-day weather accurate when you try to make a forecast on out beyond a couple of weeks, but you can get the overall flavor of the winter outlook.
So USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says what that means for the United States is...
During a La Nina winter, you have warm and drier than normal conditions across roughly the southern half of the United States, extending all the way from Southern California through the southern half of the Great Plains, and then also along the Gulf Coast to the Southern Atlantic region.
At the same time,
for the winter coming up, the winter of 2021, we do expect colder than normal conditions on average from the Pacific Northwest into parts of the upper Midwest.
Meanwhile, the greatest likelihood of snowy conditions this winter is across the northern part of the country.
So the Cascades, the Northern Rockies, the Northern Plains, all expected to have a snowier than normal winter.
He says there already have been signs of that over the past few weeks.
Since late October, we've had a series of storms that have dumped significant snow in some of those areas across the north. That type of pattern is likely to continue.
Meanwhile, he says the snowfall outlook for the Ohio Valley and parts of the Great Lakes region is a wild card.
Those areas will be battling temperatures that could be near or above average. So sometimes that can translate into some very significant snowfall. But again, each individual storm has its own flavor. So, you know, you can have a borderline rain snow event, but at the same time, you move a little to the north and west, we can get significant snowfall.
He compares this coming winter to the most recent one.
If you want to go out on a limb a little bit and just kind of play the odds, you could probably get away with saying overall, it's going to be a colder and drier winter as a whole.
Based on scientific analysis, he points to one safe bet.
It's likely to be colder than what we saw a year ago. We had our sixth warmest winter on record in the winter of 2019-20. It was also very wet. It was a top 20 wet winter as well.
And again, he adds La Nina to the mix.
You put that all together, it's unlikely that we'll match the warmth and the wetness that we saw during the winter of 2019-20.
This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Meanwhile, in the almond orchards, it's slow going. The Western Farm Press reports that this year has indeed been different from most. It's been a difficult crop to shell out, according to growers. Wildfire smoke prevented the crop from drying out like it normally would, so they had to deal with a lot of moist almond hulls that make it difficult to shell efficiently. They had to slow down the processing plants in order to accommodate the wetness factor. So when will the extended almond season wrap up? All the fields have brought in product already, and they're projecting they'll probably finish a bit before Christmas.
With less than 2 weeks before the current spending package expires, lawmakers are working on a package to fund the federal government for the remainder of fiscal year 2021. R.J. Carney, American Farm Bureau Federation Congressional Relations Director, says negotiations are ongoing.
The federal government is currently operating under a continuing resolution, which will expire on December 11th. The House and Senate have agreed to top-line spending amounts for all 12 appropriation bills. The next step is for the subcommittee chairs to finalize and agree on the specific allocations within their specific bill.
Carney says Farm Bureau has a list of priorities for the agriculture spending bill, including an extension and additional funding for the Wildfire Hurricane Indemnity Program, or WIP Plus.
This is critical for the farmers and ranchers impacted by the numerous hurricanes, the derecho, the flooding, and the wildfires that have persisted throughout 2020. The derecho is currently not a qualifying disaster event because under current USDA guidelines, unlike hurricanes, derechos are not named storms. So AFBF is requesting there be a policy change to allow farmers and ranchers impacted by the derecho to receive funding for the WIP Plus program.
Carney says it appears Congress has all intentions to finalize 2021 spending bills.
There are a lot of politics still to play out over the next 2 weeks, and a lot of discussions will occur both within the House and Senate committee chairs, but then also within the leadership and in coordination with the White House. If Congress is unable to come to a resolution, then we would likely see another continuing resolution, which would extend early into the next Congress and the new administration.
Michael Klimitz, Washington.
Here's USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey with a look at the national weather outlook for the period of December 8th through the 14th.
We are expecting much of the country to have near or above normal temperatures. Greatest likelihood of warm conditions across the northern plains and upper Midwest. We may see some chilly conditions lingering, however, across the south, especially from the southern Rockies eastward along the Gulf Coast and into the southeastern U.S. Meanwhile, once we get through the end of week storminess, we expect relatively tranquil conditions to occur across much of the country next week. Vast majority of the U.S. expecting near or below normal precipitation from December 8th through the 14th. One exception might be some wetter than normal weather across the High Plains region from Montana southward through parts of Colorado and western Kansas.
A little closer to home for the southern Sacramento and northern San Joaquin Valley, that period of 8 through 14 of December looks to be, unfortunately or fortunately, sunny skies, no rain in sight. Daytime highs in the mid-60s, overnight lows in the mid-30s, but dipping down into the low 30s by Saturday the 12th. Next chance of rain, according to AccuWeather, December 23rd, maybe. Here's this week's California crop report. In Tulare County, fields are being disked and planted with other forage crops. Winter grain and silage crops, such as wheat, oats, and barley, are being planted. Wheat fields have had up to 6 inches of growth. Silage corn is mostly harvested. Alfalfa is being cut and baled. The cotton plowdown has finished. Sedan grass was being cut, dried, and baled. In the Sacramento Valley, winter wheat planting is complete. Newly planted alfalfa is irrigated to keep the new crop growing. Harvested rice fields were being flooded for decomposition. Persimmons continue to be harvested. Kiwi fruit and pomegranate harvests were coming to a close. The table grape harvest is almost completed. Wine grapes are being harvested. Grape vineyards that have been picked were being pruned for next year's crop. Some raisin vineyards were removed in preparation for nut orchards. Navel oranges continue to mature with harvest underway. Mandarin, lemon, lime, and pineapple quince harvests continue. Olives continue to be picked and processed. In the nut orchards, pecan and pistachio harvests continue to progress. Late variety walnut harvest is wrapping up. Nut trees are being pruned for next year's crop. In the vegetable fields of Sacramento, Solano, and Yolo counties, fall groundwork continues. Melons were picked. Down in Tulare County, fall vegetables were being picked for local farmers' markets. Garlic and onions were planted. Kale, lettuce, and broccoli have sprouted. They're being irrigated. Winter vegetable fields were prepped for next year's crop. Out in the pastures, non-irrigated rangeland and pasture land was in fair to good condition. Irrigated pasture was in good to excellent condition. Sheep are grazing on retired cropland as well as in harvested grain fields. Cattle supplemental feeding is ongoing. Beehives are coming into California for overwintering in anticipation of the 2021 almond bloom. Don't forget the KSTE Farm Hour is available on your schedule. You can listen to it live, of course, at 6:50 on the AM dial here in Northern California, or stream it live via the iHeartRadio app. And, of course, the KSTE Farm Hour is available as a podcast. Download it from your favorite third-party podcast aggregator, and that includes the iHeartRadio app, Apple Music, and Google Play. After several years of playing second or third string to neighboring counties, the Western Farm Press reports that Fresno County has held its top spot as the leading county for gross agricultural output in all of the United States, though the dollar figures between the big three were probably the slimmest in history. By the way, the other two counties vying for that top spot are Tulare and Kern counties. All three have exceeded $7 billion in value each of the previous three reporting years. It's a testament to the agricultural output of the region. At over $7.7 billion in gross receipts for 2019, Fresno's crop values were 2.3% lower than its record year of $7.9 billion in 2018, which also led all counties in gross agricultural output. The reason for the softening of the commodity prices? Difficult year for wine grapes may have played a part in that reduced value. Fresno County Ag Commissioner Melissa Cregan said the lower figure was somewhat surprising given increases in almond acreage, Fresno County's leading crop, as well as higher acreage reports from other significant crops, including navel oranges. Fresno County farmers harvested over 264,000 acres of almonds across the county in 2019. Total production that year was up 29% to 309,000 tons. That's almost one quarter of all the almonds produced in California. Fresno has seen two of their commodities produced there exceed a gross value of $1 billion, and that would be almonds and grapes, although grapes did not fare as well in 2019. Almond values, which included the edible nut and the hull sold for livestock feed, exceeded $1.5 billion in gross value on yields that were up 21% over the previous year. At number two, grape values slipped below $1 billion on softer prices. Raisins remained the most popular type grown at over 81,000 acres. Bearing pistachio acreage was up 7% on the year to over 117,000 acres, that according to the report. The alternate bearing nature of the crop saw a 30% swing in yields from the previous year down to just over 2,700 pounds per acre in prices that averaged just over $2 per pound to the grower. The Fresno County Ag Commissioner expects pistachios to make the leap into elite value status as more planted acres move into the bearing category. And here come the pistachios. The Western Farm Press reports that the October pistachio inventory report puts crop receipts at 1 billion pounds. It broke the billion-pound barrier for the first time. And as you might imagine, they have to move all those pistachios, and a full court press is underway to sell the crop through marketing strategies that include cooking demonstrations with celebrity chefs, as well as presentations with food writers. Meanwhile, the Almond Board of California is projecting its first ever 3 billion pound crop as growers experience a significant price reduction following last year's underestimated production forecast.
We have seen a significant improvement in our projections for U.S. exports.
Agriculture Department Chief Economist Rob Johansson has just released those new projections for the 2021 fiscal year that began in October.
We're estimating fiscal year 2021, our exports will be at $152 billion. That's up $11.5 billion from our August forecast.
And would be up about $16 billion or 12% from this past fiscal year.
And that's driven primarily by record volumes of soybean and corn exports.
Soybean shipments could bring in a record $26.3 billion, corn about $13.2. Both of those numbers much better than what USDA was projecting just 3 months ago. Of the $152 billion worth of total U.S. ag exports being projected, $27 billion of that will come from purchases by China.
That's largely due to strong soybean and corn demand.
We are about 2 months into this new 2021 fiscal year, and as we all know,
we are seeing a substantial increase in China imports of U.S. products.
A lot of corn, a lot of soybeans expected to flow into that country.
China has been rebuilding its swine herd, and that is driving significant demand for feed.
Johansson says if these projections hold up, China would, after 2 years being off the top of the list, regain its status as the top buyer of U.S. farm products. Meanwhile, not only are overall U.S. ag exports to the world expected to soar, but also
we are seeing an increase in our imports of agricultural goods as well.
USDA's chief economist says the U.S. could be bringing in $137 billion worth of foreign ag products,
up about $4 billion from last year,
and a new record high. So subtract imports from exports,
and that leaves us with a trade balance of $15 billion positive.
This past year, the ag trade surplus only amounted to a bit over $2.5 billion. So definitely, this could be what Johansson calls
a healthy recovery in the trade surplus in agricultural goods
and in the U.S. ag trade situation in general. This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
A federal judge has ruled that the USDA has correctly refused to turn over farmer information to a company that analyzes and sells data to agribusiness suppliers. The Capital Press reports that U.S. District Judge Timothy Kelly has ruled that USDA's records about farmers and the size and location of their operations are exempt from disclosure under the Freedom of Information Act. Farm Market ID is the data company that sought the information that, when combined with other public data, could lead to identification of individual farmers, as well as reveal information about their farms and their financial status. The potential public benefits of releasing the data don't outweigh those privacy concerns because there's no evidence of fraud in USDA programs and because information about individual growers does not directly shed light on USDA operations or activities, that according to the judge. The ruling affirms that Congress intended to shield geospatial information as well as farm data submitted by growers in order to get them to participate in USDA payment programs.
The November Cattle on Feed report shows the number of animals on feed as of November 1st is higher than it was this time last year. The report provides monthly estimates of the number of cattle being fed for slaughter. Scott Bennett, American Farm Bureau Federation Congressional Relations Director, says the number of cattle on feed has largely followed seasonal patterns, but since August has been running above recent years' levels.
Most significantly, the report showed a total inventory of 11.97 million head on feed in the United States, with large monthly carryovers to offset a drop in placements. This is the highest November inventory since the series began in 1996.
Bennett says placements, described as new animals being placed on feed, were lower than expected.
Placements were 11% under those from a year ago and more significant than the 8.9% decrease estimated by analysts. While the placements in October of 2019 were record high, we've been running ahead of year-ago placements since April and May during the height of the pandemic.
Bennett says the near-term future will be dictated by how COVID-19 impacts the supply chain.
This report would be considered neutral to bullish. Looking into the future, the big question mark is how much a resurgence of COVID-19 affects packing capacity. While we do not anticipate it to be as challenging as it was this spring, the risk of plant closure still lingers in the air.
Find a complete analysis on the market intel page at fb.org. Michael Clements, Washington.
USDA has received more than 700,000 applications and paid out a little more than $11 billion for the second round of the coronavirus food assistance program.
So that's greater than CFAP 1, both in the number of applications and in the dollars. And so certainly CFAP 2 is designed to cover a broad range of agriculture producers out there.
USDA Undersecretary Bill Northey says there are still funds available.
We think the program could be up to $14 billion, so we could have have another nearly $3 billion that we would pay out. We think at least $13 billion for the total program of CPAP 2.
More information can be found at farmers.gov.
Nothing in the works right now for a CFAP 3. There'll be a few tweakings of what we're doing, but CFAP 2 is the second big and currently final program.
The deadline to apply for CFAP 2 is December 11th. This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Poinsettias and other holiday greenery have been selling well at California's nurseries. The California Farm Bureau Federation newspaper Ag Alert reports that one Sacramento area nursery chain, Green Acres Nursery and Supply, says its poinsettia sales have doubled from a year ago. Marketers say people appear to be decorating their homes early during the pandemic, but adds that poinsettia sales to churches could decline due to restrictions on indoor services. In other news, nurseries say pre-cut Christmas trees have also been selling briskly. And we are talking with Quentin Young, manager of Fair Oaks Boulevard Nursery here in Sacramento. Are Christmas trees selling more briskly at Fair Oaks Boulevard Nursery than last year?
Yeah, they seem to, we seem to be selling more earlier. So usually people, you know, our busiest day would be the day after Thanksgiving, when traditionally everybody would come out in big groups to buy their tree. Instead, we were selling them earlier, and they were being delivered actually even before Thanksgiving, which was unusual for us. But people were at home. They wanted their tree. They wanted something festive to put them in a good mood. So we seem to be selling more earlier.
And Quentin, in order for a retailer to distinguish themselves in a market that is filled with cut Christmas trees, how has Fair Oaks Boulevard Nursery set themselves up?
I think it's because we have a kind of a loyal following for our trees. We carry noble firs, which are known to hold really well. We wash our trees down every day. They were hand cleaned when they first came in, so there's no needles. So that's really important to a lot of customers, that the trees are clean and fresh, and they were fresh cut and put in water when we got them, and then they're fresh cut again when they leave here, and they include the stand and the bowl. So it's sort of a full service versus your typical, you know, grab a tree that might be sitting on a lot and you don't know when it was cut, and then you have to tie it on your own car and drag it into your own house. We take care of all of that for you.
Yeah, expand upon that, because that's what really sets aside Fair Oaks Boulevard Nursery in the rather crowded Christmas tree market, is the fact that you will take that tree to the customer's house and set it up for them.
Exactly. And we put rubber tips on the feet. We carry it in. We put it exactly where you want it. We don't leave till it's straight. So basically, all you have to do is open your door and point, and we take care of the rest.
Quentin Young, Fair Oaks Boulevard Nursery, thanks for a few minutes of your time.
Thanks, Fred.
While some of us are cutting back on buying some products because of COVID-19, there is at least one commodity that is doing very well.
Rocking around the Christmas tree at the Christmas party hop.
Well, we already know that it's a record year for sales.
Tim O'Connor helps run the National Christmas Tree Association. He says Christmas tree lots and tree farmers have been reporting sales a lot higher than in recent years, and he says the pandemic may be at least part of the reason.
As people wanted to have a family Christmas at home, wanted something authentic and real, wanted an outdoor experience with their family to go get a tree.
Many tree lots and choose and cut farms have had what O'Connor calls a tremendous first weekend. Some opened a week early this year because of customer demand, and some have even reported
they might make it through one more weekend, and then many of them will have no more inventory left. They've had such a run.
But O'Connor says everybody will be able to get a tree, but as the holiday approaches, it might take a little extra hunting to find the special one. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Have you selected, cut, and taken home your natural Christmas tree for the holidays? Whether you have or not yet, before you put up that tree and decorate it, there are important tips to consider. That's according to Mississippi State Extension expert John Kushla.
One of the first things you want to do, whether you move it into the house or not, you want to put the tree in water. You're going to want to cut about an inch off the base, perpendicular to the stem of the tree. You want to make sure that the tree stand you have is sufficient size for the tree that you have. You want about a quart of water for every inch of diameter for the tree.
Once the tree makes it inside the residence, Kushla says it is important that it is placed in a cool area of the home.
You'll want to put it right next to a fireplace or a heating vent or open window. I know a lot of people like to display their tree so neighbors can see it, but at the same time, that's really not the best place for the tree unless that window is on the north side of the house, because heat's going to dry that tree out faster.
Now, when it comes to decorating the Christmas tree, natural or artificial,
you want to use decorations, particularly lights, that are low voltage so they don't get as hot, like the LED lights or the mini lights. And certainly, for safety reasons, you want to unplug those before you go to bed or leave the house.
Kushla says one thing people may not realize is that a natural tree is less of a fire hazard than an artificial tree.
People might not realize this because a lot of artificial trees are marketed as being flame retardant. They're basically made out of wire and plastic. And if you've ever thrown a plastic cup into a fire, you will notice what it does is it flashes. And the same thing can happen to an artificial Christmas tree if the lights that you have on it are worn and they spark. It's not going to take but a moment for that whole tree to just go up in flame, even though it has fire retardant on it.
Whereas the natural tree taking in water cannot burn until all water evaporates. Kushla adds that the freshness of the tree can be determined prior to cutting or at the Christmas tree lot. The scent of the tree, the fresh evergreen out of the forest smell, is a good indicator of freshness, as is the snap of a pine needle, producing a sound much like the snap of a fresh carrot. A broad-based reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Well, it's a beautiful November day. We're up at Isley's Nursery in Auburn, and they're having an open house. And what we're staring at are tables and tables of beautiful poinsettias. Isley's is known in the fall for their collection of poinsettias. In the spring, they're known for their tomatoes. But right now, we're talking with Bill Isley. And Bill, these are gorgeous poinsettias. How many varieties do you have here?
Now you got me.
All right. I'll start with an easier question.
Yeah, there's two different types of red. And then we have the Jingle Bells, Orange Spice, Mayonnaise, Ice Punch, Pinks, about 9 different varieties.
And, of course, I imagine in the spring these all become tomatoes.
Yes, this will be the vegetable production house.
Right. How long have you been propagating and growing poinsettias?
My father and uncle started doing the poinsettias in the early 70s. I took over production of the poinsettias in 1978.
A while then.
A couple of years.
Yeah, a couple of years. Local nurseries love your product. They love the poinsettias because they're healthy. They grow well, just like your tomatoes.
Yes, they do. So we ship, you know, to other nurseries, to the forest here in Northern California and Western Nevada.
Yeah, it's interesting to see a poinsettia production going on here in Northern California. You tend to think of this as a Southern California institution, but if, as long as you got poly roofs and probably a large PG&E bill, you can get away with it.
Yes, we can. PG&E loves us.
All right. It's mostly gas heat, I would think.
Yes, all gas heat. And then in the summer, we have these big draft fans and then the cooling pads, just like an old swamp cooler to cool the houses down to keep them at temperature.
And, of course, these will be gone probably by mid-December?
Yes, around December 15th, except for there are some churches that wait till the 20th or so of December before they take theirs.
All right. And these are in some very nice pots here. You got all of these in ceramic pots.
Yeah. Yep, they're all in clay pots. We are one of the last ones to do them in clay pots. But since I sell to nurseries and florists, we don't want it to look like mass marketers, so we stay with the clay instead of the plastic.
It's excellent. It's just fantastic here. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen so many poinsettias in one place. Are you unique to growing this in Northern California? Maybe over in the Bay Area there might be some.
There's still quite a few poinsettia growers here in Northern California. Lodi, Galt, over on the Half Moon Bay and stuff. So there's still quite a few of us growing.
Give us some care tips for poinsettias.
You want to keep them away from drafts, away from the front door, away from any heaters, any wood heaters if you're heating with wood, and you want to keep them in filtered light away from a window. Like on your dining room table, it's perfect.
All right, and they're good till what, February or so?
Yes, they would should last you at least until Valentine's Day if you're taking good care of them.
And I imagine at least once a day somebody comes up to you and says, now how can I get this to last all year?
Every day.
Every day,
they do. Yeah. You can't get it to stay in color year round. It is going to revert back to green, and then you have to start the process all over where you're cutting it back to get new shoots, and then it's water, temperature, and fertilization to get it to come back into color.
Not to mention a long period of darkness.
They're not as much as the old varieties. Mm. The new varieties, they actually light up. And we have enough ambient light coming in from around the nursery. I do not light them because it's more of a dull color. They do not have the vibrant color if you light them or use black cloth. So we just use natural light.
All right. So for those attempting to, shall we say, oversummer their poinsettias and get them to rebloom or to recolor, because we should point out, and we haven't done that yet, that the actual flower of the plant is this center part.
Center part.
The cyathea.
Yes. The bract is what colors up, and it is not the flower.
Right. The bract is a modified leaf, and people say, oh, what beautiful flowers, when in reality, it's a beautiful leaf.
It's a beautiful bract. Yes, the leaf.
Pests of poinsettias. I don't see any white flies here. Congratulations.
Thank you. We are on the white flies all the time. We do two treatments. We have lucked out this year with the white flies, but they're more susceptible now to root rots than what they used to be. That is our big thing. I'm actually been treating the poinsettias every 15 days for root rot.
Well, that would be another cultural tip then,
yes.
Is for people, don't put them in pots without drainage. They need good drainage.
They have to have good drainage, and you let it dry out before you water it again.
Right.
You do not want to keep it wet all the time.
Poinsettias, it's a beautiful plant for the fall. They do so well here. They're everywhere, and they're up here in Auburn. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
How about killing some weeds with steam? The Ag Alert newspaper reports that steam treatments of soil appear successful in reducing weeds in vegetable fields, and University of California farm advisors say they're studying ways to make the process more practical. Heating soil to about 150 degrees with steam can kill weed seeds before they germinate, but can be too expensive and time-consuming. But by treating a narrow band of soil in the field, farm advisors say the process becomes more affordable.
21-year-old male, multiple gunshot wounds.
From all of the TV medical shows, you would think that only city folks need sophisticated health care, but what about rural residents?
These folks have to have access to all of the quality of life that people have in the urban areas.
Including health care, but in some places there are no nearby hospitals or clinics. Few, if any, doctors, fewer specialists. And that's especially troublesome during this COVID pandemic. There are efforts, of course, to help correct the situation and provide more rural residents with better access to health care. And we'll hear about just a few of those efforts on this edition of Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford. In the rush into the holiday season and Thanksgiving and all of that, National Rural Health Day may have slipped by you. It was back on November 19th. It's a yearly observance created by the National Organization of State Offices of Rural Health. This was the 10th Rural Health Day, designed to point out the need for better access to quality health care by rural residents, and to point out progress along that line.
And USDA is excited to be part of this.
Beth Green helps run community facilities loan and grant programs within the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Rural Development Mission.
We're partnering with rural communities across the country to help residents and workers get access to modern, convenient health care services.
To that end, Green says in this last fiscal year, USDA invested $572 million.
Specifically to health care in our community facilities projects. This funding helped to build or improve medical centers and hospitals.
Or to help buy much-needed equipment for rural medical facilities. Here's an example of what's being done with one agriculture department loan. This one's a pretty large-scale project.
In Michigan, the Bay Mills Indian community will use a $6 million loan to construct a 34,000 square foot medical office building in Chippewa County. And the Bay Mills Indian Community Reservation is located on a federally designated medically unserved area and a health professional shortage area. More than 20% of this community's residents are people with disabilities. So this community facilities investment will help provide medical, dental, pharmacy, lab, imaging, behavioral health, optical, community health, and traditional healing services.
Of course, some rural areas find themselves with a pretty good medical facility, but with few, if any, doctors or nurses willing to move to those rural areas and work in that facility. Efforts to lure more doctors into rural areas have had very limited success, but recently
there's been a focus on trying to get people access to technology rather than trying to get specialists out to those areas.
Online technology connecting rural area medical facilities with their urban counterparts and connecting individuals with doctors. Chad Roop runs the Agriculture Department's Rural Utilities Service. That's the agency that is known traditionally for its loans to and support of rural telephone and electric companies. More recently, it's been heavily involved in awarding loans and grants to help bring high-speed internet access to rural areas and in the process, again, to connect rural clinics with their more elaborate urban counterparts and connect rural residents with doctors and specialists.
So our distance learning and telemedicine program, last year we put out about $71.5 million across the United States to give people the access to the technology so they can see their specialists from those clinics in those rural areas, and they can get all the healthcare needs provided without putting themselves at risk and having to travel to urban centers and have increased costs as a result of it.
And increased exposure to COVID-19. And speaking of that,
certainly the COVID pandemic has taught us really the benefit and the necessities in many cases of telemedicine.
That was Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue on hand for an event announcing that new round of telemedicine loans and grants amounting to $72 million for 116 projects in 40 states and Puerto Rico. One of the grant recipients is Hospital Sisters Health System in Wisconsin. Josh Gustafson with that group says the money will be used for equipment and facilities to bring better health care to many underserved areas of that state.
And ultimately, this grant will save lives and will improve patient outcomes, as well as the quality of care.
And on a national basis, as Ag Secretary Sonny Perdue, Chad Roop, and Beth Green all said to me in their own way,
increasing access to telemedicine distance learning is critical to building healthier and more resilient rural communities.
It will allow them to really prosper right where they are.
Because we know that when rural America thrives, all of America thrives.
This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford, reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
There's a growing demand for local wheat, whole grains, and heirloom varieties, reports the Ag Alert newspaper. That's encouraged some California farmers to try to serve those specialty markets. The California Wheat Commission has been attempting to develop the state's local grain markets and created an online database to connect farmers with small millers, bakers, and other end users. Although California has large wheat milling capacity, relatively little of it is dedicated to specialty milling.
USDA has been looking at two notable events that have affected the beef industry: the fire at a processing facility in Holcomb, Kansas, and the coronavirus pandemic.
Our efforts were focused on being able to look for answers to help the beef industry understand what happened and why, and what could we do to maybe keep the market swing and the reactions in the marketplace from having adverse effect on producers in the future.
Greg Ibaugh is USDA's Undersecretary for Marketing and Regulatory Programs. He recently spoke at a webinar sponsored by the Extension Risk Management Education Program.
It's a very important topic for me as well that we figure out how producers deal with market swings more effectively, and we also look at what caused those and what USDA and other segments within the government may or may not be able to do to be able to help out at times like that.
There are three areas that USDA has been focused on.
We wanted to make sure that we looked at price discovery, competition, and transparency to make sure that those tools were active and those those features were available to producers.
Meanwhile, he points to some proactive activities USDA has been engaged in to address beef industry concerns.
Within that bucket of what can the USDA do, some of the things we pointed to was producer education. And Market News is one of the stalwarts of the Ag Marketing Service. We produce a number of reports each and every day that are available to livestock producers.
He says he's not sure if everyone is aware that not only do these reports exist, but people can customize the data and information to make it more individually relevant.
We also identified another opportunity in that some of our reports, their titles were ambiguous and some of them indicated that they may not be final reports.
He was referring to what used to be known as estimated slaughter reports for cattle, which are now known as actual slaughter reports.
So we changed the name of some of our reports that we thought would help the market react to actual slaughter each and every day.
He also noted findings that USDA needs to do a better job encouraging livestock producers to use risk management tools.
Grain farmers embrace risk management tools provided by USDA each and every day, and our livestock producers don't do that at the same level.
This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Thanks for listening to the KSTE Farm Hour, heard every Sunday from noon until 1 p.m. Pacific Time, and available anytime as a podcast at kste.com.